the Flight Cast, a place where opinions aren't right or wrong, and where we can agree or disagree about movies, TV, and other assorted media, because it's all subjective. My name is Ray. Thank you so much for joining me today. I have another movie review episode. I do. I have another movie to talk about, but I'm taking this in a slightly different approach. I'm not just talking about the movie. I got a couple of angles to talk about this one here. I'm talking about Dune. Obviously, the movie that just came out, the most recent Warner Brothers legendary pairing, and that has been kind of famously and infamously teased, and just so much backdrop. Like, if you're on social media and if you're in any of our circles within any geekery that we talk about, like, just so much being made out of the movie itself and, like, all the stuff behind it, all the Denis Villeneuve stuff. But I have a couple of angles that I want to take with this before, like, getting directly into the film. So it's going to be a little different, but hey, for once, I'm actually going to be reviewing a movie that isn't a comic book movie. It feels like between this and Fans Without Borders, I'm just reviewing comic book movies, whether it's Zack Snyder's Justice League or Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings or Black Widow or The Suicide Squad or Venom, Let There Be Carnage, whatever. I think that's all of them. Is that all of them for this year? I think so. I don't think I missed any. Not yet. And of course, we've got Eternals and Spider-Man No Way Home coming up later this year. But yeah, here we go. This is a big one. This is a big, huge one. And I want to start by talking about my history with the source material for Dune. I don't know if everybody that listens to the show has ever, like, either read the book or seen the movies. And it, well, okay, movie, I suppose. I guess it, if, you know, there, this thing has been adapted multiple times, right? The novel, I think, by Frank Herbert was originally done in the 60s, and since then, you know, there's the 1984 David Lynch adaptation that, you know, features Kyle MacLachlan and a really young Patrick Stewart and Sean Young as Chani and a couple of others. Like, it's one of those where, like, when you, Virginia Madsen's in it for a second, it's one of those 80s movies where, like, you watch it and you see the cast and you're like, okay, I know that person. Yeah, there's a lot of those. And it's just one of those, like, kind of cult classic 80s sci-fi movies, right? So there's that. And then the Sci-Fi Channel, well, Sci-Fi Now, but back then, I think they were still called the Sci-Fi Channel. In 2000, they did their own miniseries for it, right? They did it in miniseries form for the TV channel, did an adaptation. They also did a Children of Dune from, I think, I want to say that's the Brian Herbert novels. I'm not 100%. Scott will know that. Scott from, look, you want to know anything about Dune, like the novels or anything like that, ask Scott from Squadcast Media. He has all the knowledge. He and Meg, Wonder Meg, they've been chronicling, like, all the book and, like, the movie developments and the action figures and all the unboxings. They're, like, the experts of all that is Dune. Really, I'm not an expert, right? Like, I've seen the David Lynch movie. I haven't seen the sci-fi miniseries. I have read the book. There was a number of years ago that I read the book, actually, believe it or not, for an English class at one of the same school that I went to film school, Mott Community College up in Flint. I actually, like, it was one of those cases where, you know, for the final project, it was like, okay, read a book that is in the top 100 novels list. And that was a perfect opportunity for me to read it because it was like, I've wanted to read this book for, like, a long time. Like, I've known, like, since knowing that this was a book, I've wanted to read it. And so I took that opportunity to read it. It was a number of years ago. I have not picked it up since. I'm kind of inclined to read it again, to be honest with you, especially after seeing the most recent adaptation that I'm going to talk about here. But yeah, it's an epic novel. I mean, it is an epic story and draws a lot of parallels. You know, a lot of people are like, well, clearly this is the inspiration for Star Wars, and it's the inspiration for, you know, it has Lord of the Rings stuff in it. It's got Game of Thrones parallels, all kinds of different things that, you know, like other franchises that people can connect to it when they try and describe what this is. But it's a giant, sprawling epic, and there's, like, so much world building. It's not a small book by any stretch of the imagination, and it is one where if you are a fan of world building and if you really want to see some religion and some politics in addition to, you know, whatever action happens, like, yeah, this is one of those incredibly epic storylines for sure, with a ton of characters and just a world building. That's really the best phrase, the really best word that anybody can use to describe what it is. And so that's my experience with it. Like, it came on Sci-Fi like a good amount of time. They used to show it, I want to say, like 2 or 3 times a year, the Lynch film, the 84 movie. And so I would watch it. And that's when I found out that it had a bunch of different versions, right? There's like the regular 2-hour theatrical version. And then there's this longer 4-hour version. And then there's the, I think there's the Alan Smithy version. Like, there's a lot of different like lore with respect to the different versions of the movies that there are specifically out of that cut. And it was always one of those, like, when I saw the David Lynch movie, I was like, okay, this is 1984, so they're limited in what they can do. And especially after finally reading the book, I'm like, okay, 1984 was too early for them to try and do a story like this any kind of justice in live action. To their credit, they did as best as they could. But, you know, the technology of the time limited their abilities. So when they're like, okay, we're doing this again, like, it's going to be, but in 21st century visual effects, you're talking like, this movie was supposed to come out last year, pandemic delay, we know, supposed to be out last year, it's now out now, October 2021, but you're talking about an epic like this in these times, right? Like, something with modern day visual effects, all the stuff that we're used to seeing, you know, with the comic book movies and with the other action films that we have come to know and understand and expect, right? That level of quality, in visually speaking, and in terms of storytelling. That was exciting. That was a very exciting idea. And that leads me to the other angle that I want to take for this review before I get into the movie, and that is the director himself, Denis Villeneuve. Now, let me put aside all of the drama and all of the ridiculousness that I've talked about with him earlier this year. Let me just talk about my exposure to his movies in general. It started with Blade Runner 2049, because Scott, I will reference Scott again, but not just him, but also a number of others, a few other people, like I think a couple of my coworkers at the time back at the station, all told me the same thing. They said, Ray, I think it's better than the original. And as soon as I hear that, the first thing I think is, son, your ego is writing checks your body can't cash. Because the original movie is a masterpiece, right? Ridley Scott's Blade Runner, 1982, Harrison Ford, Edward James Olmos, Rutger Hauer, may he rest in peace. Sean Young is in that movie too, amazingly enough. Fantastic film. Incredible movie. Now that's a book I definitely need to read. I need to read Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep by Philip K. Dick. The novel, the original novel that served as the inspiration for Blade Runner. I would absolutely love to read that book at some point. But the movie is a cult classic. It didn't necessarily do well when it came out in 1982, but it was like, it's considered, you know, top tier science fiction filmmaking. And I'm a huge fan. I have the version, I have the Blu-ray version that has like, I want to say all 5 or 6 versions of the movie, the work print, the final cut, all that stuff. Like, I've got every version of the movie that exists that has like ever been seen, essentially. It's not that special version with the briefcase and the origami figure. No, it's nothing like that. It was just, I went to Target one day and they had it in the regular Blu-ray case, you know, with the 5 versions of it. It's a 5-disc set, and it was supposed to be $34.99, and it was mismarked at $14.99, and they had to give me that price. It's one of the few times that I've ever done that, because being a retail veteran, I have too much sympathy when that happens, but this was a case where it was like, no, I'm going to do this. Like, it's not like I go into stores and warn them about bad prices. No, I don't do that. I just don't say anything. But in this case, I wanted the Blu-ray. So I'm like, yeah, give me that price. And the person at the service counter had to begrudgingly sell me that set. But yeah, huge fan of that movie. So they're like, 2049 is better. And I'm like, okay, you know what? We're going to test this. So one day I was like, at home, and I turned on Comcast On Demand, and they had Blade Runner, the original, and they also had 2049 available on demand. So I did a dual watch, right? I'd seen the first one many times, but I did a refresher. I wanted it fresh in my mind going into 2049 for comparison's sake. And after watching that, and then after watching 2049, I was like, damn it, they're right. Subjectively speaking, of course, it's all subjective. I'm sure there's somebody out there that feels that the original cannot be surpassed, and that as great as 2049 is, it can't possibly surpass the original, or maybe they don't like 2049. I'm sure somebody out there is like that. It's not me, though. Blade Runner 2049 was a fantastic film. It was an outstanding piece of work, and it introduced me to the concept of Denis Villeneuve's filmmaking, because I had never, like, experienced it at all. And it's weird, because he already had a handful of movies that had gotten critical acclaim and were, like, really well-known that people were aware of, and I just hadn't watched them. Like, he wasn't on my radar at all until that movie. And so I see that movie, and then I want to say maybe it was, like, a year or so later, I did a blind DVD, or not a DVD, a blind Blu-ray buy of Arrival, because Best Buy had one of their steelbooks. I think it was a Project Pop Art, or it was one of their special art steelbooks for Arrival on sale. It was like $10. And I was like, I haven't seen this movie. I vaguely know the premise of this movie. You know what? Sight unseen, let me watch it. I'm probably going to enjoy it. And I did. It was amazing. It was one of those movies that just, as a science fiction fan, just warms your heart. It's just like, all right, you know, good. There are still filmmakers out there. There's still storytellers out there that respect the genre like this and believe in the power of vision and sound, you know, visuals and striking sounds to tell, you know, a hard sci-fi story or something as close to a hard sci-fi story as you can get with something like this with today's world. It was really good. It was amazing. Arrival, outstanding film. If you haven't seen that, that's Amy Adams and Jeremy Renner and Forest Whitaker. Really good movie. So I'm like, all right, I am now officially baptized into the world of Denis Villeneuve films. And I know the guy can do science fiction. Yes, he's outstanding at science fiction. There's no question about it. But I needed to see his other movies. I did. I needed to get caught up, because there were like three. And he's done like, I want to say he's done like 9 or 10 feature films, right? I think like 3 or 4 of them are Canadian, or like French-Canadian, because I think, if I'm not mistaken, he's from Quebec. So, I haven't seen any of those, but there are 3 big films that have come out in the States that are, like, you know, kind of the ones that are so critically acclaimed, people are like, okay, you've got to see these, you've got to check this out. Enemy, Sicario, and Prisoners. Not in that order, because I think the release order, that I think Enemy was first, then Prisoners, and then Sicario. So I had to see all 3 of those. I had to get caught up on my Denis Villeneuve watching, because it's like, seriously, how do I not watch the rest of this guy's catalog, knowing that how brilliant I feel Blade Runner 2049 and Arrival are? So I made it a point to watch those other 3 before watching Dune. And I did, and I've posted a review of Sicario up on the Patreon for all the patrons, patreon.com/theflightcast. My review of that is up there. Pending this, like shortly after I post this review for the public, I will also be posting reviews on Patreon for Prisoners and Enemy, most certainly. And Enemy is a double, because that's my first A24 film ever. So yeah, definitely got some creepy crawly thoughts about that particular film as well. I've got some crazy thoughts about Prisoners as well, but I'll be posting those reviews on Patreon. But yeah, the world of Denis Villeneuve, like his filmmaking, he is absolutely a true auteur, and he's one of those filmmakers that I would put in the same category as Christopher Nolan or David Fincher or Zack Snyder, you know, the types of filmmakers that absolutely have a style. And, you know, when you know what their movies are within the first couple of minutes, you know, 30 seconds to a few minutes of watching one of their movies, you get into it and you're like, okay, this is a Denis Villeneuve movie. This is a Christopher Nolan movie. This is a Zack Snyder movie. Yes, absolutely. He totally has that type of style all to his own. And it comes out so much in Dune. So, like, I'll get into it now, because at this point I can get into the crux of the movie. And this is going to be non-spoilers. And it's weird with this particular movie, because even though it's non-spoiler, it's like, okay, well, I've read the book. The book's been out for a while. This isn't like a brand new thing. I mean, it is for the general audience, right? Anyone in the general audience that has never seen Dune, or has never read the book, it's a brand new thing for them. But like for me, and like for many others who have been aware of this for decades, it's not a new story. You know exactly what the story is. And really what you're looking for when you watch Denis Villeneuve's version is you're looking for how he did it. You're looking for, like, what, you know, what changes did he make here? What devices did he employ there? How did he decide to tell the story? Like, what's his version of this story look like? And quite honestly, I think hands down, and I, to be completely fair to this, I would have to go and watch the sci-fi miniseries. But I can tell you that just looking at the theatrical, you know, the cinematic presentations between this and the David Lynch film, like if I were comparing, right? And it's not a fair comparison, really, because again, 1984, 2021, right? They did what they could back then. But this particular adaptation of Dune is, this might definitely be his magnum opus, Denis Villeneuve. This is a incredible film, and I expected nothing less, seriously. Like, it, especially now that I've watched more of his movies, you know, beyond just the science fiction, now that I've seen Sicario, now that I've seen Prisoners, now that I've seen Enemy, I have an idea, I have a very clear idea of what his style is, and I know what to expect with his type of storytelling, not just visually speaking, not just in terms of sound, but also in terms of the story itself, the types of stories that he gravitates towards, and the type of storytelling that he employs. One of the things that I really like that he does, there's two things that I really like that he does. Well, it's more than two. Why am I limiting? I shouldn't be limiting. It's not just two things. He has a whole list of things this dude has that I just thoroughly enjoy in terms of his storytelling devices. I love the fact that more often than not, when you get to the end of his movie, it's not really unresolved. But it's not unresolved in the sense that he's beating you over the head in terms of whatever the ending is. He gives you the ending and you can make the conclusions in terms of what has happened, but it's not force-fed. You're not beaten over the head with it. It's like, okay, here, it doesn't treat you like an idiot, right? It doesn't treat, his movies do not treat the general audience like they're stupid, but they also don't treat the general audience like they're geniuses either. It's not like, okay, you really got to have high-level thinking like you're reading a Christopher Priest graphic novel or issue of Deathstroke in order to understand exactly what the hell is going on. No, we're going to meet you in the middle here, right? We're not going to spoon-feed you, but we're also not going to starve you either. We're going to give you enough that you're going to be able to figure this out and go along as and follow us down this road and see exactly where we're headed. And it's really not going to be an unresolved story at the end, right? And, you know, Nolan, I know some people, I got into arguments years ago about Inception because there were people that were like definitively not, you know, like, they didn't like the fact that he came out and said definitively what the ending of the movie was, even though I liked it because it was the ending that I thought it was, right? But generally speaking, he doesn't do that. At the end of The Prestige, there's an ending, and you know what the ending is. At the end of the Dark Knight trilogy, there's an ending, and you know what it is. It's very clear, right? That's generally speaking how, at the end of Interstellar, there's an ending, and it's very clear. It's not ambiguous. Villeneuve does the same thing, but it's not quite as blatant. So I dig that. I also love his visual style because he really does a great deal with scale and does a great job of really placing you in the middle of the action at times and also showing you just how crazy huge some of the landscapes and some of the giant sprawling visuals are that you're seeing, right? I saw it in Arrival, saw it in Blade Runner 2049, of course, saw it in Sicario and Prisoners, and it is on display to massive effect in Dune. Now, I want to say this. I'll go ahead and get this out of the way. I did not see this in theaters. I didn't. I was not able to go see this in IMAX. If I'm still able to, like if it's still in theaters for a while, which it could be, who knows, I will endeavor to try and see this in IMAX. If I don't, I'm not gonna freak out over it. Listen, I can tell. I mean, you can tell just from the trailers and just from the TV spots. This is going to be an incredible experience on IMAX, especially, you know, not just because of the size of the screen, but also because of the sound. If you've been to a digital IMAX theater, you know, one of the really good ones, you know that those speakers are loud. That sound is booming. And not every film that is presented in IMAX takes advantage of that sound. This is a movie that would probably shake me at least 5 times if I saw it in an IMAX theater, and I'm sure it did for any of you that did see it in IMAX. The sound probably blew your eardrums out at certain points, and you know, especially when it comes to, you know, like the sound effects, the Foley, the score, which I will absolutely get into that later, and how immaculate that is from Hans Zimmer. But like, the sound of this film is like very much the soul of this film, in addition to the visuals. And I do realize that if I don't see this in IMAX at some point, that is an experience that I will be missing out on. I do recognize that. Contrary to popular belief, I'm not anti-theater. There are people out there that are going to tell you I'm anti-theater because I've been arguing pro-digital and pro-streaming for at least the last year or so, probably longer than that. But I am not anti-theater. I am pro, this is going to sound weird, I am pro-choice. I am pro the audience being able to have the choice to watch their films either in the theater or on streaming at home. And this was a case where I literally did not have the capability, whether it was financially or in terms of time, to be able to go see this movie in an IMAX theater. But you know what I did have time? You know what I was able to do? I was able to turn on HBO Max and watch it on a 20 on a wider screen. If I say how big the screen was, some of you are just going to, like, your skin's going to crawl. I know some of you theater elitists, and I know some of you purists out there are going to be like, oh, I can't believe it. I will assure you that I didn't watch it on a cell phone. I did not watch it on my iPhone. I did not watch it on my iPad. Okay, I watched it on a larger than normal screen that somebody would have at home. That is as much as I will tell you. I didn't watch it on, like, a big screen. I may have watched it on a TV screen, but I certainly did not watch it on a tiny computer monitor. No, the visual medium that I watched it on is not a normal visual medium that most people have at home. I will say that. So I did not get the theater experience, but what I did do, I will say this, I did have, you know, because I have a Mac Mini, I did have, like, the, you know, I had the my AirPods, and I specifically have AirPod Pros, so I tried to get the sound as immersive as I could for not being in a theatrical experience. And I know that, did you listen, I basically drove a speedboat in a bathtub, according to Denis Villeneuve. Yeah, whatever, okay. I still don't like that he made that comment, but just to get on the record, I didn't see this at home out of spite. I said I was going to a couple of months ago when he really pissed me off with those incredibly elitist comments. That is not why I saw this movie at home. It had nothing to do with that. It was just literally a matter of convenience and a matter of the availability. So it was one of those cases where I literally was part of the audience that couldn't necessarily get to the theater. And if I can't get to the theater, hey, no worries. I can still see this thing in all its glory, thanks to HBO Max. So I will sing the praises of the HBO Max hybrid plan. I know there are people out there that don't necessarily dig it, and there was a big brouhaha with it, but I guarantee you that there are people that have, today, as you listen to this, I guarantee there are people that have seen Dune now that wouldn't have seen it if it wasn't on HBO Max. I guarantee that. Yeah, and I'm sure, you know, if we wanted to do independent research, you know, can we always trust Warner Media with numbers? No, certainly we cannot. But I'm sure that if we did a level of independent research on that, we could find some people out there, no doubt about it, that were not interested or didn't have a shot to see this in the theater, but gave it a shot because it was an HBO Max and they were at home and the accessibility was there. So I applaud that. I am glad that that was there. I know that we're not going to get that next year because they're going to the 45-day theatrical exclusivity window, but I'm glad I had the option to see it here. I'm glad I did. You know, and another thing that it gave me the option to do was subtitles. And that's something that I do just in general, like, because I want to be able to understand what is being said. And of course, in the theater, you don't have, you know, like, it's not a case where you can't, unless you're using one of the assisted listening devices, you're not going to have that at your disposal. So it's like, all right, well, you don't have that option there. But if you're at home and you have the option, why not? Why not? Because otherwise, in your head, there'll be that little voice in the back of your head. You're going to hear something. And there are points in this movie where there are whispered things and there are phrases said. And you're like, what? What did they say? And maybe some of you caught it. Maybe some of you did. Those of you who have read the book, those of you who have seen the previous films or adaptations, those of you who know the words being said in the movie, you might have been able to tell what they were saying. I kind of doubt it. Personally speaking, I kind of doubt it. But for anybody else, you'd hear this and be like, I don't know what they're saying. I don't know what's being said. Like, what is it? Is it a foreign language? Whatever it is. Like, and the captions told me exactly what it was. So now I have that context. I'm like, yes, awesome. It's part of the home viewing experience. So with that in mind, yeah, I watched this thing at home. In fact, I literally just watched it. I want to say, like, maybe half hour or so ago, the movie finished. The runtime was shorter than I thought it was. I think it was like 235, 236 with credits, 2 hours and 36 minutes with credits. I thought this was going to be closer to 3 hours. And I'm not complaining. I really am not. Because, you know, for one, they already told us this movie was going to be in two parts, right? That this is essentially part one of the book. And for anybody that has read the book or for anybody that has seen the other adaptations, there's a part in the story where there could be like a natural break, right? Like, there is a point where the first half of the story kind of reaches a crescendo and there's a big climax. There's a thing that happens and it'll, and basically the story shifts from the rest of the time on. This film kind of did that. Really what it did, to be very honest with you, and people who have read the book or seen the other adaptations know what I'm talking about when I say this. The movie went a little further ahead. It went a little further ahead past the natural breaking point and set up a couple of... And I understand why, because quite honestly, the way that this movie starts, it starts you in a place where they're giving you information that you don't get until like later, generally speaking, right? Like it's not a case where... Like, okay, this isn't a one-to-one adaptation, and it's never a one-to-one adaptation. When you talk about adapting a book or, you know, a comic book, we go through this with comic books all the time. When you adapt these mediums, the printed word, anything on the page for the screen, there's always going to be liberties taken. There's always going to be changes made to the story and the machinations and the character dynamics. There's always going to be changes. No question about it. And why? Because... Not just because the medium is different, but also because your audience is different. I mean, think about it. Look at the casting for this film, right? When you see Timothée Chalamet as Paul Atreides, when you see Oscar Isaac as Duke Leto, when you see Rebecca Ferguson as Lady Jessica, when you see Zendaya as Chani, when you see Javier Bardem as Stilgar, when you see Aquaman, Jason Momoa as Duncan Idaho, and Thanos, Josh Brolin as Gurney Halleck, like, there are enough names in this cast that somebody was like, hey, someone in the audience, you know, some Marvel fan will know that's Thanos. Or maybe they saw Deadpool 2 and they know that's Cable, right? Or an Aquaman fan will see that Aquaman's in the movie. Let's throw that in. Or Zendaya fans. There's got to be Zendaya. There's tons of Zendaya fans out there. They'll see she's in the movie, right? There are people, like, this movie was cast with that in mind. With the idea of, okay, let's bring in the general audience. And when you're trying to bring in the general audience, you can't be one-to-one to the book. You just can't. It's just not going to work, right? How Frank Herbert wrote this story is not going to attract the general audience in a visual sense. It just isn't. So the changes that Villeneuve made between the novel and this story, I welcome. And I, you know, when I do these reviews, I try my best not to, when it's an adaptation, and especially when it's something that I've read before, I try not to judge it against that adaptation. I really don't, because it's not fair. It's not a fair thing, and I went through this years ago with friends of mine that were huge fans of the Harry Potter book series, and then they'd go and see the movies, and then after seeing Goblet of Fire, they'd tell me 1,000 things that were wrong and why it was the worst movie and why they totally cut this out and they messed this up, and it's like, guys, it's not the book. Read the book for accuracy, right? The movie is going to be different. Like, understand that, please. So many people just fail to understand that. Whether they're, and the general audience, by and large, doesn't care, but a lot of the fans, right, the diehard fans of the source material, they're the ones that, like, hold the movie's feet to the fire if it's not exactly how it's supposed to be. But I try not to compare this to the book. I want to judge these films on their own merits. And on its own merits... Like I was mentioning before, like so much of what of Villeneuve's style and what he does in his films is all over this movie. I love the sense of scale that he presents in this film. And that was one of the biggest things that I was curious about was the technology. How's the technology of this time, you know, in the year 10,000, what is it, 101 or 10,198, I believe, is the year that this is taking place, right? Like, how are we going to approximate? I saw how they tried to do it in 1984. How are you going to do it in 2021? It's gorgeous. It's absolutely gorgeous. It is pristine. It is outstanding. And I know it's computer generated. I know it's not really there. But you know, I think that with Villeneuve, he's one of those filmmakers that has the ability to blend practical and like CGI, like computer generated imagery together. And he understands lighting, he understands composition, he really understands colors, right? He knows everything that is supposed to be present, like how things are supposed to look practically in order for the visual effects to work. And he plays with light and shadows and darkness in all of his movies. He totally does it in this one, and it is to his advantage. It really is. Like when he stages a lot of the set pieces with respect to the, you know, these massive ships, these massive spaceships and these hovercrafts and these, or what is it, the Orthonica or the Orthocopter, like the, you know, like it's a it's basically a helicopter, but it's like a dragonfly. It's got like dragonfly wings. I think that's what they're called, orthocopters, right? Something like that. When you've got all these machinations, and you've got like that droid that Paul that is like in Paul's room, and he's got the book tape, you know, like the digital book, you know, like essentially an audio and visual book, which gives you a lot of exposition, right? And a lot of the exposition that was what I was talking about earlier in terms of like the changes that were made. A lot of the exposition that you get the beginning of this movie is stuff that you don't get till later in the book, right? There's actually kind of a twist that happens in the book that is not a twist, like in the, and I don't want to take complete credit for that because Stephen Colbert mentioned that on Vodka Stream. We talked about this on Vodka Stream just the other night. I hadn't seen it yet, but he and Dave and others had seen it, and that was what he was saying, and he's right. He's absolutely right. There is a twist in the book that is no longer a twist in the film, and it just, it's part of that whole adaptation thing. It's like, okay, if you're going to tell the story differently and if you're going to be cinematic with it, like what changes do you have to make narratively speaking without sacrificing the heart of the story, without sacrificing the essence of Frank Herbert's original work? And to me, I feel like the changes that were made, including that one, absolutely maintain that and respect Frank Herbert's original work. But visually speaking, this movie's flawless. Seriously, this film is utterly flawless in terms of any of the practical stuff that they did, in terms of any of the CGI imagery that they did, the tech, you know, how it's represented. You know, it felt a lot more real to me. Like, there was a lot of real-world stuff, especially when you look at, like, the controls and, like, the dash controls, like, on the orthocopter and, like, all the different, like, things, all the devices that they've got, the handheld stuff, you know, the communicators that they have, like, right behind their ears. Like, all of it had, like, a practical look and feel to it where it's like, okay, that is plausibly real. Like, it's amazing. Like, this is 10,000 years in the future, or I guess 8,000 years in the future, but like it looks like believable, like believable tech. Like it looks like that landing gear is actually like landing. It looks like, and when you see it juxtaposed against these armies and massive amounts of people and like the procession and, you know, the House Atreides and their armies and all the soldiers, it's like, wow, this is insane. And the landscapes, you know, that's another thing that Villeneuve has a great eye for is landscapes and like set pieces and establishing shots. He loves establishing shots in his movies, and there's like so many of them in this movie. And it was not just the desert, but like the, you know, for all of the locations, you know, because it's not just Arrakis, the Dune planet. There's also Caladan, which is where House Atreides is. There's Giedi Prime, which is where House Harkonnen is. Like, there are, and it's a, each world is distinctly different. And what you see in each of those worlds, like, embodies, visually speaking, what is the case with whoever lives there, right? When you're on Caladan, like, for the time that you're there with House Atreides, and you see the water, and you see the what looks to be a normal atmosphere that any of us would completely recognize, you know, it you feel it, the lushness that is there, right? The hydration, if you will. Like, there is kind of an emphasis. It's not like they're swimming underwater or anything, but there's definitely an emphasis, even subliminally, to be like, there's water on this planet. There's totally water on this planet, which is important because they're going to Arrakis, a planet with no water, a planet that is a complete desert. You know, that's the whole point. Dune, desert planet, right? Desert power, which I love that phrase, desert power. And how that's reinforced throughout the movie is really clever and really awesome. I really enjoyed that. But yeah, you go to Arrakis, and you know, that's when you see the still suits, and that's when you see this whole idea of filtering water from people's sweat and tears, and literally like capturing the moisture out of bodies so that they can stay hydrated. It's crazy, but you look at it on screen and it's like, okay, that is a very realistic representation. There's nothing false about this. It's not like they got these crazy steampunk devices that they're using to filter all this stuff. It's real stuff that you could buy, like somebody would make, that would, you know, do the job in a world that has absolutely no water whatsoever. And then you go over to Giedi Prime, you look at the landscape of the Harkonnens, and it's like dark technology, right? It's like, is there a sun on this planet? Doesn't look like it. Looks like this planet is in constant cloudy, gray, black darkness, and all of the you know, the whenever they decide to make technology evil, because technology isn't inherently evil. The people that use it can be evil, and it can be used for either side, good or evil. But in this case, when you're trying to make technology look evil, you paint it black and you put it in like dark gray and you light it really crazy and funky, and you just make it as cold and lifeless as possible, right? And that is what, that's literally how Gedi Prime feels when you see it, right? When you see, you know, and of course that's Stellan Skarsgård as Baron Vladimir Harkonnen. In my opinion, not nearly as disgusting as the 1984 version, but again, you know, there's so much playing with light and colors and, like, you know, different shadings in this, and he's far more sinister. Skarsgård's version, he is far more sinister, and he's one of those where it's like, oh, you know he's evil, and you know he's a bad person, but, you know, it's not like mustache twirling necessarily. There's definitely some politicking here. And of course, Dave Bautista as Glossu Raban, and you've also got David Dasmalchian, who's just a chameleon, as, and he, man, is he getting some work or what? David Dasmalchian, our good buddy, Brent, our good buddy from DC TV Squadcast. Brent always gets a kick out of me saying that, because Brent did actually interview him for DC TV Squadcast a couple years ago when we were still co-hosting that show over on Squadcast Media. But man, he is getting some work, and he loves Warner Brothers. I mean, they'll put him in just about anything, whether it's The Dark Knight, Gotham, The Flash, The Suicide Squad. He's no stranger to Denis Villeneuve. He was in Prisoners. He's a very ubiquitous type of actor, but he also has this way of playing like really creepy characters. So of course, who's he playing in this one? Piter. Of course he's playing Piter. For reference, Brad Dourif, yeah, voice of Chucky, he played Piter in the 84 version. You'd also know him as Wormtongue from Lord of the Rings, any of you Lord of the Rings fans. Yeah, that actor, Brad Dourif, he played Piter in the original 1984 Dune adaptation. So yeah, that's the character that David Dasmalchian was playing. And somehow, I think Dasmalchian's version was like creepier. But you know, getting into the cast of this movie, that's another thing that I've really determined about the genius of Denis Villeneuve's work as a filmmaker, is he understands that half the battle of his films is the casting. And seriously, like, now having seen like five of his movies, like having seen a vast bulk of it, well, six now if you're counting Dune, having seen a vast bulk of his catalog, you know, outside of the French Canadian stuff that I was talking about earlier, which he has done some features over there, like, when I look at Prisoners, when I look at Arrival, when I look at Blade Runner 2049, when I look at Enemy, when I look at Sicario, and when I look at Dune, like, they all have the same theme of the people that you cast understood the assignment and understood the assignment incredibly well, right? You know, and it's not like you're casting anybody for the sake of anybody. You're casting someone for a particular role because you actually feel like they will fit that role and they will bring the energy, they will bring the gravitas that you need for them to play that role. This is the first Timothée Chalamet movie I've ever seen. Never seen any of his other work. Really never heard of the guy until he was cast as Paul in this movie. And he was fine by me. I really had no issues with how he played the role whatsoever. I thought he played, you know, there are times where, you know, he's gonna kind of be, you know, the way that Paul is, you know, at least how he's constituted. There are times where he's got to be like a young kind of wooden kid, and, you know, like, is kind of clumsy in terms of like expressing emotions. But there are other times where the emotion is raw, you know, like any of his, you know, his encounter with the Bene Gesserit, right? Or like any of the visions that he's having, like, throughout this film. Like, there are certain times where it's like, okay, he's got to turn on the emotion and he's got to reach that extra gear. And I feel that he does. I do. I feel that he does reach that extra gear. And, you know, I give him a lot of credit because he's doing this in the presence of so many other heavyweights. I mean, the right off the bat, the one that he's working off of, the one he's playing off of the most in this movie is Rebecca Ferguson, and she is a massive heavyweight, and I have seen her in more than a few things. It was introduced to her through, you know, Chris McQuarrie and Tom Cruise and Mission Impossible. Rogue Nation was the first one where her character, Ilsa, showed up. And, you know, I was introduced to her there, and I've seen her in other things. I've seen her as an absolutely despicable villain in Dr. Sleep, And even though I absolutely despised her character and needed to see her die in the worst way in that movie, she was still, like, it was one of those performances where it was like, you were so evil, like, you're really good at this. Like, it was a really good performance. You are making me hate your guts, and you're making me want to see you lit on fire and burn so that I can hear you scream. That's how horrible her character is. And Dr. Sleep, if you've never seen Dr. Sleep, if you are not familiar with the character of Rose the Hat in Dr. Sleep, just look it up, right? Maybe you don't like horror movies. Okay, fine. Just look up Rose the Hat and read what that horrible person does in those movies, and you will understand why I felt that strongly. But Rebecca Ferguson plays that, I mean, she's got great range, and here, like, she takes that to a level that, you know, I haven't personally seen, because I haven't seen her in roles quite like this, where, you know, she's got to play this, and this is a character that I know, like the Lady Jessica character, and it's like, all right, how is she going to do this? And I didn't have any doubts. I had no doubts at how she was going to play it when she was cast. I was like, okay, you know, and I, if I'm not mistaken, and I'm drawing a lot of comparisons to the Lynch film, because quite honestly, when I talk about the Dune property, I remember more out of the Lynch film than I do out of the book. I do, because I've seen the Lynch film multiple times. I've only read the book once, right? But if I'm and also because if I'm going to do any comparisons, I feel like it is more fair to compare this film to the other film, right? At least it's in the same medium. Her character, Lady Jessica, if I'm not mistaken, was played by Francesca Annis in the 1984 David Lynch film, right? And so obviously that was played a very different way and had a very different tone. What Rebecca Ferguson is doing here is, I mean, it's so much more emotional, and there's so much more gravitas to her character, and there's more depth, and, you know, she just brings a seriousness and also, like, this odd warmth, right? You know, like, knowing what she is and knowing, like, what type of character she's got to be, but she's still, you know, like she's got all these responsibilities, and she's got the weight of so many things on her as a character, but she's also still got to be Paul's mother. And Paul is still her son, right? It's still one of those cases where, like, she's got to be his mom despite everything that is happening to him that may or may not be on her watch. And I don't want to go, for anybody that hasn't, again, I'm trying to stay generally spoiler-free. It's tough. It's tough with something like this. Like I said, it's been around for decades, and this is at least the third time in live action that this particular story has been adapted. So it's difficult, right? You know, I mean, there is still probably a vast sector of the general audience that had never heard of it until now, right? But still, at any rate, she was phenomenal. She was absolutely aces. Had no complaints whatsoever. There are no complaints with this cast at all. Oscar Isaac is Oscar Isaac. It was crazy seeing him with a thick gray beard, but the idea of him playing Duke Leto, yeah, absolutely. Yes, played that off well. You know, the Brolin playing Gurney Halleck, I'll tell you why that was weird for me. Because Patrick Stewart plays Gurney in the 84 version of Dune, and it was like, okay, so I'm so used to, like, seeing, and remember, that's 3 years before Star Trek The Next Generation, right? That's 3 years before that show started. So it's like, seeing that Captain Picard as Gurney Halleck, and now I'm supposed to imagine Thanos as Gurney Halleck instead of Captain Picard. It's crazy. It's weird how, like, all this, how all these roles and, like, all these actors kind of, like, you know, mesh, and, like, you know, how things come full circle and weird stuff, like, how that happens, right? But he was great. Like, I mean, Josh Brolin is Josh Brolin. He's outstanding actor. You know, I really dug him in Sicario. Like, he was, like, this darkly hilarious character in Sicario. So that's where his, you know, experience with Villeneuve comes from in this regard. And yeah, he was great. Of course, Jason Momoa was great as Duncan Idaho, and they gave him his time to shine, no doubt about it, in terms of, like, the physical combat. There were times where I was like, okay, you don't have Aquaman powers, dude. Are you really going to do that? Yeah. Okay. I guess you are. He was awesome. You know, there were a couple of other actors that, you know, like, outside of, I mean, Zendaya, of course, is Zendaya. Like, I really do enjoy, like, what she does, and I haven't seen a ton of her. I haven't seen Euphoria. I've heard so many glowing things about her in Euphoria, like, in her performance and what she's done. I believe she's won Emmys for that, if I'm not mistaken. At some point, I would like to dig into that show. The show seems really heavy, though. Like, I don't know if I want to. I'm a little hesitant, because of how heavy that show looks. But at some point, I do want to, like, see some of her other work. But, you know, so far, like, I mean, I had no issues with how she played this role at all. And I'm eager to see what she does going forward. I'll talk about that here in a second. But, like, she was good. Like, I had no issues with her. Javier Bardem is Javier Bardem. And, you know, him playing Stilgar, yeah, for sure. I mean, there's no issues there. Like, I didn't have any. Like, there were no issues with this cast. None. None whatsoever. I mean, this dynamite cast, absolutely dynamite cast. Like when you're if you're looking for weak links, I really don't think you can find any. And I want to point out a couple of the other cast members that aren't readily known even to, like, fans necessarily. But, like, Stephen McKinley Henderson, who played Thufir Hawat, he's been in a handful of things. I think the first thing I saw him in was The Newsroom, where he played a character in a couple of episodes of the first season of that show. And he's a that guy, and he's been in a bunch of other things, and you may have seen him here and there. He was great. He was awesome. Like, for the moments that he was in the movie, he was really good, like, for his character. I also want to point out Sharon Duncan Brewster, who this is a change, right? They changed the character of Leah Kynes, Dr. Leah Kynes, like that. And the change that they made for this character, I like how they changed the character. I like giving her that role. I liked her in this role. Like, I thought that she gave a you know, kind of like a bigger gravitas to this role than what we've seen from Matt in the past. I liked how she played it. So that was cool. I also want to point out really quick, Babs Olosomokun, who played Jameis, one of the Fremen. I am going to see him a lot more in the coming year because he got cast as Dr. Mbenga, Jabila Mbenga, in Star Trek Strange New Worlds. I am excited to see him in that. He's not necessarily in this movie for a whole lot, but still, just as soon as I saw him, I was like, oh, hey, I'm going to see him in Star Trek. That's going to be awesome. So I am looking forward to that. For the time that he was in the movie, he was cool. You know, again, I have no complaints. I have, like, no complaints about the cast in this movie. Like, they did a great job. Like, everybody played their roles, like, as well as they could possibly play them for a film that is this sprawling of an epic, that has this much gravitas to it, that is this much of a sci-fi, you know, just badass epic. And this is where I will now get to the incredible badassery that is Hans frickin' Zimmer. Hans Zimmer is a madman. Hans Zimmer is, like, I mean, we're talking top five composers of all time, right? And if we want to put him, you know, if we want to start talking about him in the category with, like, Williams and Elfman and James Horner and some of the other classic and Jerry Goldsmith, absolutely he's up there. There's no question he's up there. I mean, his body of work was already that great before even getting to this. And so it was like, okay, you know, and he'd worked with Villeneuve. He and Benjamin Wallfisch did the score for Blade Runner 2049. And, you know, sadly, you know, like with Villeneuve, a lot of his films, at least a lot of the films that have come out here, you know, like Arrival and Sicario and Prisoners, those scores were done by Johan Johansson, and they were amazing scores. Johan unfortunately passed a number of years ago, you know, after Arrival? I don't remember. I'm not sure when it was, but, like, they're very atmospheric scores that are rooted in, like, electronic basses, right? And Zimmer is no stranger to that. So it was kind of a natural evolution, kind of a natural progression. It's like, okay, unfortunately you can't work with Johan anymore. Who's the next best that you can get? Well, Zimmer. You know, and Johan and Zimmer really, like, they're kind of from the same school where I've talked about this before here and also on Ed Squadcast Media, the difference in compositions with film composers where the old school was like big, huge, bombastic brass themes and giant orchestras and every character has a definitive theme and it's reinforced throughout the film and all that stuff, right? And it's something that you can whistle, something that you can hum, you know, whether it's the Superman theme or the Indiana Jones theme or the Star Wars theme or something like that, right? Or the Batman theme or Spider-Man's theme from the Raimi film, something like that, right? And that's what those composers did. And then you have the Zimmer school of composers, you know, like the people like him and also like Rupert Gregson-Williams and a number of others that their themes, it's not like they don't have themes, but they're more atmospheric and they really serve to just support and complement what you're seeing on screen, and they're there to match the visual style and energy of what you were seeing on screen, not in a sense where, oh, I'm going to be whistling the Dune theme when I'm in the car. No, nothing like that, but just something that is going to stick in your mind and it's going to evoke a feeling, right? Like, just subliminally speaking, there's going to be a feeling that you have when you hear this music and when you see the sand and when you see the visuals and when you see the colors and the lights and the lighting and everything. And Zimmer just fit this entire aesthetic as brilliantly as I could have possibly guessed he was going to. Like, seriously, like, there's a tone and there is a feel for this movie, and half of it is how it sounds. And it, like I said earlier, the Foley and like all the sound effects are amazing, but also just the design of Zimmer's score around all of it is absolutely breathtaking. It fits the landscapes, it fits the action, it fits the drama. There is a theme. Like, there's definitely a theme. There's definitely, like, a reinforced theme throughout, but it's very elemental, and it's very, you know, it's not something that, you know, it might be in your head, but it's not necessarily something you're going to whistle, right? Like, it's a handful of notes, and it's not supposed to be catchy, right? It's not a marketing ploy, which is what, a lot of times, that's what it was with a lot of those bombastic themes, right? They want you to remember, they want you to whistle the E.T. theme, you know, because it's a marketing ploy. It stays in your head. They want you to whistle the RoboCop theme, right? If I'm pulling from another movie, that was Basil Poldoris, who did the score for Paul Verhoeven's film back in 1987, right? That was a different mode of thinking. And that hasn't gone away. Like, we still hear that at times with certain films. But here, with this school of composing, this is more atmospheric, far more atmospheric, and definitely serves to fit the visuals and the sounds that you are taking in. It's meant to be a sensory experience more than just, you know, a theme that you're reinforcing here. And yeah, all of that was just absolutely outstanding. No, this was, I mean, Dune, I had high expectations going into this particular film, not, you know, because of everybody that was involved and, you know, having seen Villeneuve's work, and in this case, you know, like, you know, going into it before I got caught up on all of his other, you know, I guess, but for lack of a better way to put it, before I got caught up on his American released films, I already had high expectations for what he could do in the realm of science fiction because of Arrival and Blade Runner 2049. And so going into this, I was not surprised whatsoever to be blown away completely by what he does. This is a brilliant film. This is an absolutely gorgeous film. And yeah, they put part one in the beginning of it for a reason. They did. That, you know what? That could be, you know, that's, I guess that's kind of a mini spoiler. I don't know, but that's been part of the discussion. So it's really not a spoiler, right? This whole idea of, well, they only shot the first half of it. You know, we've got to see how it does in order for them to do the second half of it. Okay, they're doing the second half. I am quite confident that they're going to do the second half, to be very honest with you. And I don't even necessarily, you know, I'll pop up here on Box Office Mojo for a second. As of the time of me recording this, I don't have any of the domestic numbers from the opening weekend, but this thing's been out worldwide for a minute. It has. And it already was at $147.2 million worldwide before its official domestic release, which, right, actually, you know what? This is counting 17.5 million domestic at this point. Now, by the time you hear this episode, more than likely, like if you listen to this on a Sunday or after that, they're going to be updated numbers. That number is going to change, and we're going to get all of the U.S. numbers involved in it. But my point is this: even though they filmed this, like they didn't do the back-to-back thing where they're like, okay, let's shoot everything for both parts at once, and then, you know, we'll worry about it going forward. No, they even though they did that, we're getting a part two. I don't envision a scenario where they are just going to ignore part two and dismiss it. Because and part of the reason for that is not just, you know, that we'll see how it does box office wise. This is kind of a reversal from what I and many others were thinking originally, because, you know, even before the pandemic, we wondered how well this movie was going to do at all in the eyes of the general audience. We were worried, based on Blade Runner 2049's bombing, that the general audience just, you know, they have no connection to this. They don't know what this franchise is. We have to assume that they've never even heard of Frank Herbert, let alone his original work for this. So it's like, okay, you're introducing them to a brand new thing. It's a niche property, despite the fact that, you know, I've had people argue with me, it's one of the best-selling novels of all time. Yes, that the general audience hasn't read, largely, or has never heard of, largely. That's just the long and short of it. It's not a bad thing. It's just factual. But these numbers tend to suggest that, okay, maybe it is going to do a little better than what we were thinking. It's not going to be like a, like, I don't know if it'll hit like half a billion or anything like that, but it definitely seems to be attracting some attention and making some money. This may end up making more than Blade Runner 2049 did in the pandemic era, which would be intriguing if it does that. But it's not just that being the reason that they're going to do this. You also have to look at the fact that this is part of the HBO Max hybrid plan. And yes, there was drama behind that, and there was, you know, Legendary was upset about it, and Villeneuve, of course, was famously upset about it. I still don't like his extremely elitist comments about Speedboat in a Bathtub. I think those were stupid things for him to say. That being said, that still leaves this movie as a piece of HBO Max content for the service. Now, because of the 45-day theatrical release window that's going to kick back in next year for all of Warner Brothers films, the sequel is going to end up being in that window. Okay, fine. Point of the matter is, they're going to drum up popularity for that by sticking this thing on HBO Max permanently after, you know, this particular window, right? It's on HBO Max right now, and you can enjoy it for like the next month as part of the whole, you know, the hybrid plan for the 17 movies that they released, you know, day and date this year. But at some point, this is going to be in the HBO Max library, and when it comes time to push, you know, the envelope for the sequel, push the marketing for the sequel, it's, you know, they're going to be using this to push that for sure. And also, you know, there's still talk, I don't know how far this has gone, but there's still talk of the TV show plans that they're going to do, the HBO Max original series for Dune, which I don't know where that's going to take place or, like, you know, what the timeline is. And I think I heard stuff about that. I also heard stuff about a Bene Gesserit show that they might be doing for it as well. I haven't heard a whole lot about it lately, but it does seem, based on certain chatter, that Warner Brothers has some form of franchise plan for Dune. And they can. I mean, Herbert had enough material, right? Between what he wrote and between what Brian Herbert wrote, there is more than enough Dune material for them to do a number of projects. They can continue doing films. They can do series, right? They can do a number of things with this particular project. It's not just this story. This is the third time that Frank Herbert's original novel has been adapted for live action, whether it was the Lynch film in 84 or the sci-fi miniseries or this, but there is way more in terms of the material that they can expand upon. And if they want to do that, so be it. And I think I don't see why they wouldn't, truthfully, especially when you consider that HBO Max, you know, I've said this before, the lifeblood of all streamers is original content, right? You know, you can have all the vast libraries of old content, you know, from way back when as till you're blue in the face, you know, on any of these services, whether it's HBO Max, Disney Plus, Amazon, Hulu, even Netflix, whatever it is. You can have all these vast libraries. At the end of the day, the general audience wants something new. They want the new content. It's always, what have you done for me lately? Like, what is the newest thing that you can present me on your service that I can't get somewhere else? And this offers them another option, another opportunity, another potential for a franchise. Now, is it going to be on the same level as DC? No. Is it going to be on the same level as Harry Potter? No. It doesn't need to be, though. It doesn't even need to be on the same level as Game of Thrones. And I'll just go ahead and address this, too. I really am not digging these comparisons. Like, I forget who did that quote about how, you know, there was a quote about this film that said, this is the Star Wars Lord of the Rings of this generation. No, stop that. Stop that. It's not Star Wars. It's not Lord of the Rings. It's Dune. It's its own story. Leave it be. Right? Are there similarities? Yes, of course. Desert planet. Paul is essentially Luke Skywalker. It's Game of Thrones in space. I've even said that to people. I'm not going to say that to people anymore. I'm not. It's one of those things where I feel like it's a phrase to dumb it down for the general audience. And I don't think that's fair to the source material. I also don't think it's fair to the general audience. Because if I go and tell 10 random people on the street that Dune is like Star Wars meets Lord of the Rings, they're going to be looking for Luke Skywalker parallels. They're going to be looking for lightsabers. They're going to be looking for the One Ring and Frodo Baggins parallels when they go watch this thing. And when they see none of it, they're going to be disappointed. And it won't be all entirely their fault. It'll be partially my fault because I gave them unrealistic expectations, setting them up with a comparison instead of allowing this story, instead of allowing this particular piece of work to stand on its own for what it is. Dune is what it is. Now, look, did they have to pitch it to the idiot Warner Brothers executives? Is this? Sure. Sure they did, because that's how executives in Hollywood work. You have to compare it to something that everybody, that they know, right? You have to compare it to a previous film. This is literally part of the pitch process. I was told this in film school, that when you pitch screenplays to executives, you have to have in your pitch, like, a list of other things that it's exactly like, so that you can give these, the money makers, or the not the money makers, but the people who hold, the people that you want to sign the check, you have to give them a frame of reference, and you basically have to dumb it down for them, because they're stupid, essentially, in that regard. You have to dumb it down for them, or else you're not going to get approval, right? But for the audience, you know, me talking to the audience, I'm not going to dumb it down, because it's not fair to you, it's not fair to the material itself. Dune is not Star Wars. Dune is not Lord of the Rings. Dune is not Game of Thrones. Dune is Dune. Seriously. And there are similarities, there are things that it shares with those other franchises, but it is its own franchise. Plain and simple. And again, it doesn't need to be on the same level as any of those other franchises. It doesn't need to be this massive mega hit for HBO Max or for Warner Brothers. It just needs to be there as an option, not only for the fans of the material, but also for anybody that wants something different. Anybody that is interested in a story that isn't quite like Star Wars, but kind of has similarities. Isn't quite like Lord of the Rings, but has similarities. Isn't quite like Game of Thrones, but has the similarities, right? Maybe you're tired of seeing the Targaryens. Maybe dragons are not your bag anymore, right? Maybe the 8th season pissed you off that much, right? The final season of Game of Thrones. You have no interest in the prequel show. You couldn't care less because they pissed you off so badly with that last season that you won't want anything to do with Game of Thrones, but you still like the idea of that type of politics. You still like that type of idea of those of the kingdoms fighting and all the political stuff. Well, here's your option here. Maybe you're a Star Wars fan that the sequel trilogy burned you, and you have no interest in any of the Disney Plus stuff because, well, it's Disney, and you think Disney has ruined Star Wars. I tend to flatly disagree with you, but it's all subjective. That being said, maybe you're in that point where you're just tired of Star Wars. You don't want to see it anymore. Well, here's your alternative. Because if you still like all of the mysticism, if you still like all of the religious subtext, here it is. There you have it. Or if you're somebody that, you know, maybe you're sick of Lord of the... Maybe the Hobbit trilogy just really just stuck in your craw. Maybe the Hobbit trilogy just ground your gears because you loved the original Lord of the Rings trilogy, and then you saw what they did to The Hobbit, and it just really, really fried you. And you're just like, ah, I can't deal with Lord of the Rings anymore. I can't trust them with another adaptation, but I still like all of the world building. I still like all of the massive, you know, like all the different groups here, and you know, like I want to see people in this world. I want to see people in that world. I want to see them all interact. I want to see a journey, right? Maybe this is your option for that. You know, if you're tired of all that, but here's your alternative. So that's what this is. That's what Dune can be, is an alternative for any of those people, an alternative for anybody that just wants to see something different. And I know it's an adaptation. I know you could very easily read the book whenever you want. I know you could very easily watch the David Lynch film or the sci-fi miniseries. I'm guessing they have that available to watch somewhere, you would think. Probably on Peacock, more than likely, if I had to venture a guess, since sci-fi is owned by Comcast Universal. But at any rate, yeah, you have those options, or you can just sit down and watch this and prepare for the sequel and the series and everything that they're going to do. Yeah, part two is going to happen. I am confident that part two is going to happen. And this film, you know, I will give them credit where they end it, because I mentioned earlier that they ended it, in my opinion, a little further ahead than the natural point in the story that they could have ended it. Like, I agree with Stephen Colbert from Screen Rant on that. But by the same token, it's not a cliffhanger, right? It's not, you're not dangling like, oh my goodness, like what? It doesn't just abruptly stop, right? It's not like The Matrix Reloaded, okay? It's not like Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man's Chest. No, it's not like that. It is not just an abrupt stop, and then you're in a holding pattern until you get to the sequel. No, it does not end like that. There is a form of resolution for that point in the story and you know that there is more coming. You know what? It's closer to Lord of the Rings. To be fair, that is one of the comparisons that I can draw with it to Lord of the Rings. When you get how you are, where the movie's at the end of Fellowship is similar to where this movie ends. It is. It's a similar type of ending where this chapter of the story has ended, but you know there's another chapter coming for sure. But in that case, you knew there was another chapter coming because they filmed all three at the same time and they staggered the releases each year, right? In this case, they didn't do that, but they're going to do it. They're going to do it. They're going to reconvene. I am convinced of that. We're going to get that sequel, and I'm going to be very intrigued and excited to see that sequel because this film was just absolutely phenomenal, outstanding. Quite honestly, may very well be Denis Villeneuve's best work, seriously. Outstanding film. One other thing I want to mention real quick, I do want to point out, want to call attention to the director of photography of the film, Greg Fraser. This is a name that I've only started to hear in the last year, and the reason I have is because he is the director of photography for The Batman, that Matt Reeves' new epic that we saw the awesome second trailer for. We've had two awesome trailers for that now, courtesy of DC fandom over the last 2 years. He's the DP for that movie, and cannot wait for that. And this movie now gives us a taste of what his type of cinematography is going to be, and sign me up for all of that. Excellent job, Greg Fraser, with this film. Outstanding job. Cannot wait to see what you and Matt Reeves have cooked up with the Dark Knight himself down in March. That is going to be outstanding. So yeah, wanted to point that out. That was just a great job, and another massive compliment that I have to pay to this particular film. But yeah, I think that is going to do it for my capsule review of Dune here on this particular episode of the Flightcast. Like I said, I wanted to get a chance to see it and finally review a non-comic book film for this show or for any of my other shows for sure. So thank you so much for everybody listening to this. Thank you so much for your support to the Flightcast. I seriously cannot thank you guys enough for listening to this show. I've been doing this for a little while now. This is like my 78th episode. Like I'm actually gonna get to a point, won't be this year, but I'm getting to a point where like I might actually get to 100 episodes of the show. That's crazy. It's crazy. I've done like 78 of these. It's insane. Just of my solo show. Never would have thought that I'd get to that point. But it wouldn't be without you guys listening to it, and I thank you so much, all of you that have listened to it. All of you that are listening to my show, please do not hesitate to let me know what any of you guys think about, you know, if you saw Dune, if you saw this adaptation, if you're a fan, if you read the book, what are your thoughts on it? And I would really like to hear from people who have never read the book or who have never seen any of the previous adaptations and they saw this for whatever reason. I would really love to hear from people what they thought. If you are a new initiate, if this was a new thing, if this was your baptism into the Dune world, I would totally love to hear your thoughts on what you thought of this movie. That would be awesome. And also, I would be curious. I also want to know where everybody saw it. I have a feeling a lot of people saw this in theaters, and I know a lot of my mutuals and constituents in the podcasting world, I know they saw it in theaters. I would love to know who saw it on HBO Max and like, what did you watch it on? Did anybody watch this on a cell phone? I'm not going to judge. I'm not going to judge anybody that watched this thing on a mobile device. I'm not. If you watched it on your cell phone or if you watched it on your iPad, I'm not going to judge you. I'm not. That's you do you. That's what it's all subjective means, right? You do you, right? If you have the option, go ahead. Like if it works for you, it is what it is. Like just I support you being able to have that choice. But I would really be curious to know what you guys watched this movie on, if you did indeed see it, or if you're interested in seeing it, what you're going to be watching it on and how you feel about that whole discussion. But yeah, of course, you know, I'm on Twitter at the Flightcast. I can be reached by email at ray@theflightcast.com. I've got the Facebook page for the Flightcast. I'm on Instagram. Of course, I've got the Patreon as well that I mentioned earlier, patreon.com/theflightcast, where you can sign up to be a member of the flight crew, which is just the general support, $5, and then $8 is the flight officer tier, which gets you all the bonus content, which will include, like I said, my review of Denis Villeneuve's other movies that I got caught up on, Prisoners, Enemy, and Sicario. The Sicario one is already up there. The Prisoners and Enemy will be posted post-hence in the next day or so, I think. Plus, I've got a ton of other stuff there. Like, I've been doing comic reviews. I've got a comic review coming up for some Marvel stuff that I want to do, but I have reviewed Civil War and Court of Owls and A Death in the Family, among others, and there's some other stuff I'm going to review. And of course, there's my Son Just Don't rants, where I basically, you know, go unhinged and in a not safe for work rant full of curses and epithets about something that has pissed me off in the geek comedia one way or the other. The geek community. Wow. There you go. And of course, this show and my blogs can be found at theflightcast.com, and you can find this show wherever you find your podcasts, whether it's Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, any of that stuff. It's all there. Hopefully I can get on like Amazon and some other bigger areas as well. That would be cool. But anyway, thanks a lot, guys. Take care. You stay safe out there. Hope you enjoyed it, and I will see you next time.